recording. Welcome, Toby, as well. Okay, so we might have a little bit of a smaller group tonight because there's actually, I think, a Chevr Kadisha meeting going on. So I already got two emails from two different regulars who said they can't be here, and I assume there might even be a few more. So I appreciate you all coming out. Welcome, Gloria. Good to see you as well. So we'll have a little bit of a smaller, more intimate crowd tonight, but the Torah remains the same. Okay. So I want you, for those who have the actual Gemara in front of them, whether it be an art scroll, whatever it might be, you'll notice that we are actually very close to finishing the first chapter of Makos together. So right now we are on Vav Amud Beis, we are on 6B, and next week, God willing, we will get to 7A, we'll get to Zayin Amud Aleph, where you'll see it says Hadron Alach Ketzad HaEdim. That's the end of the first chapter. So this is a very important milestone because when you're learning Gemara, things could drag on for a while. You feel like you're not making any progress, but we're, God willing, going to finish the first chapter. And there's only three chapters in Makos. Third one stretches a little bit. But we're about to finish the first parak. I don't know, do we make a CM? Do we... Maybe if anyone has any schnapps that they're not selling before Pesach, we should have like a, that's what we used to do when I was a kid in school. We'd have a chametz party. Everyone would bring in chametz before Pesach and we'd all have a party. Some of you are nodding your heads. You know what I'm talking about. Or your kids may have asked you to bring it to school. So I don't know if bicultural does that. Is that I guess it depends on the teacher. We have Moer Hachman with us. She can tell us. Is that a thing? No, it's not. Okay. It was at least in Darche, but those are two very different schools. Anyway, so okay, if anyone wants to make some sort of CM or get together or something, you can contact me. We're very limited these days, but it's definitely worth celebrating. Okay, so we are on Vav Amud Beis, we are on 6B, and we start from the Mishnah all the way on the top. Now, the questions we're going to be dealing with tonight are actually questions that a number of you have raised throughout previous sessions. I kept saying, you know, you guys are way ahead of me. But now we finally got up to it. Remember, we were asking questions about, last time we were talking about how we combine witnesses together, but we're saying, do the same witnesses who see the murder happen, do they also need to give the hasra? Do they need to warn the person before he commits the murder? Because remember, there's two steps. We need to warn the murderer that murdering is a bad thing. If you do this, you will be put to death also by Beis Din. And if he says, I'm going to do it anyway, then we know it's fully premeditated. He knows the consequences and he's doing it anyway. Under those circumstances, he can be tried and put to death. So there's hasram. I'm not going to translate it so much. So just write this down if you write down key terms. Hasra is the warning that's given to someone not to commit something. And if they do, depending on the punishment, they either get capital punishment or they get malchus. They get lashes for it. So that's hasra. So to what extent is that important? So let's take a look at the Mishnah on the top of 6b. Hayushnaim roen oso mechalon zeh. Ushnaim roen oso mechalon zeh. So imagine you have two tall buildings in New York City, and on the street below, there is a murder that takes place. So you have two office buddies from one corporate building on one side of the street, on the south side of the street. And you have another group of office buddies on the north side of the street. And they're both viewing this commotion taking place. Thank you for the link, David. David just put a link to Safari in the chat. So if you don't have a Gemara in front of you, you can follow the Gemara via that link. Thank you, David. So, Bizman Shemiksasan Roan Eluis Elu, Hare Elu Edus Achas. We're told that if the office buddies on the north side and on the south side, if at least one of them is able to see one from the other pair in the other building, then they are actually considered one kat. They are considered one group of witnesses. They're not two separate groups of two, but they are one group of four witnesses. However, if they can't see each other, the imlav hare elushte idios, then they are two separate pairs of witnesses. Lefikach, in nitzis achas mehen zomemes. This we referenced this Mishnah earlier. This should sound a little bit familiar. In nitzis achas zomemes, let's say the pair of witnesses on the north side of the street in the building on the north side, they got convicted by a third pair of witnesses that turned them into Edom Zomimin. But the second pair that were on the south side of the street, they were never found guilty of Hazama. So then we have a very interesting outcome, which we've learned about. Hu Vehein Nehergin Vehashnia Petura. So then the pair that were found to be guilty of Hazama, of Edom Zomimin, they are put to death. And the defendant who they falsely accused also is put to death. Why? That's absurd. Well, no, it's not. Because the testimony of the other pair of witnesses was never disqualified. They were never found to be Edom Zomimin. So you have this funny scenario where one pair becomes Edom Zomimin, and also the defendant gets put to death at the same time. Why? Because they are separate pairs of witnesses. So they are independently reviewed by the court and can have independent statuses. That is the opinion of the Tanakhama. That's the opinion, the first opinion in the Mishnah. However, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi argues on the Tanakhama, he says, Lo'olam ein nehergin ad shiyushnei edav masrin bo shenemar al pi shnayim edim. The same witnesses that come to court and say, we saw Reuben kill Shimon, they also need to be the ones that give the hasra. They need to give the warning as well. You can't have one guy give hasra and two other people watching and then giving testimony on what they saw. It needs to be the same people who give the hasra, who then view the deed, get committed, and then go to court. And why is that? Because it's based on the words in the verse, al pi shnayim edim, by the mouth. What is this mouth being used for? Why is the Torah need to tell me al pi shnayim edim? Obviously, they use their mouths to give over the testimony. We presume by default they're not like doing it in Morse code, but rather the extra word of al pi comes to tell me that they have to use their mouth for something. What's that for? To give hasra.
Warning. So it gives them the credibility because they're a part of the whole transaction. They've made themselves into a part of it.
Ah, okay. You're saying it lends certain credibility that they are the same people who gave the warning who also are the ones giving the testimony. Okay. Let's take that down into consideration. Now, there's one other little detail right at the end of the Mishnah. It really has pretty much nothing to do with the first part, but the connection is we're talking about al pi shnayim edim, that the testimony. So we learn davar acher, another thing that we learn from the verse of it saying al pi shnayim edim, by the mouth of these two witnesses, al pi shnayim edim shlotei sanhedrin shemas mipiyam b'torgman, that the beis din, when they hear testimony, they cannot use a translator as an intermediary. They have to be able to understand the language of the witnesses giving testimony. And now, how is this relevant to Purim, right? Who knows how this was relevant to Purim? Okay, so we're told that, remember how Mordechai was able to hear over Bigson and Seresh, how they were plotting against Achashverosh, but they were speaking a language that he presumably would not have understood. But no, we're told that since Mordechai was a member of the Sanhedrin, he was, the greatest rabbinical court in the land, so he was trained in all the various different languages. So that way he would not be able to hear testimony from the witnesses that came in. So that's a place that you see. There's your late connection to Purim that I just made. All right. Pesach's coming up. We need to prepare for that. But I do have some stuff planned.
Oh, okay. Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes, Sarah. Oh,
Rabbi, I have a question. Let's say there are four people witnessing this murder. And two people give the warning, murder is bad. And the other two people want to be witnesses to the murder. And according to this, they can't be because they didn't give the warning.
Mm-hmm. That is
but true. They wanted to give the warning, only the other two people beat them to the punch.
So if they want to give it, I don't think if they, let's say the first pair gives a warning, if the second pair still has time to give a warning before the murderer commits the act, then I think that counts as giving a warning as well, according to Rabbi Yossi. So it's not like one.
So we could have a whole group of people giving warnings. Everybody could give a warning.
Everybody could give a warning. Everyone could give a warning. Yes, we're very open. You know, anyone could give a warning.
So the key to being a murderer is do it very quickly.
Okay. So we're going to talk about, actually, I have this prepared. We're going to talk about how, you know, even if you get off on a technicality, there is a form of incarceration, actually. So we'll get to that, God willing, later in the class. But don't think just because he gets off on a technicality, it means he gets off scot-free. Basin has other methods other than capital punishment to deal with people like this. So
if we don't pass them like Raviosi, though. Yes. You have two witnesses who didn't give a warning, but they heard the other pair of witnesses give the warning. They still establish the criminal knowledge, the criminal intent on the part of the murderer.
That's true. This is a gezeiras hakasav, meaning it's being inferred from the wording of the Torah. So I understand the logic that you're giving, Zadian. I think that's the logic of the Tana Kama, of the first opinion of the Mishnah, the predominant opinion. But this is the drasha. This is the hermeneutical principle that the Rav Yossi has derived for us. Okay, so let's proceed to the Gemara. And I feel like we might have some questions about, we're already starting to raise questions of technicalities and permutations. So the Gemara is going to address some of these things that might be floating in our minds. Amar Rav Zutra, Bar Tuvia, Amar Rav. We're at the beginning of the Gemara. Minayin le'edus miyuchedes shehi psula. So there's something called edus miyuchedes. The case of our Mishnah was you had two pairs of two witnesses. Now let's say you have there was only one guy in the south building and one guy viewing from the northern building. Now, do they combine? So we say no. We say shehi psula. They do not combine. Why? Shenemar lo yumas al pi eid echad. It says in the verse that one will not be put to death by one witness. My echad, what's echad? What's this coming to teach me? Ilema eid echad mamish. If you're going to tell me the Torah is teaching me that somebody will not be put to death by the testimony of only one witness, may reisha shamin Allah. Al pishayim edim. I know that already. It says in the Torah, al pishayim edim or shlosha edim yumas ames. The Torah already told me I need two witnesses. So what then is the Torah coming to tell me by excluding one witness? That's pretty obvious. Ella my echad, echad, echad. It's coming to teach me that if I have one witness over there in the northern building and one in the southern building, that they will not combine with each other to form one kat, to form one group.
Now, even if they see each other?
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that.
If they see each other? Because up above we said, if the two and the two see each other, they make one kat of four. So, two see each other, could they make one kat of two?
Okay, good. Good question. So the Brisa that the Gemara is about to quote will answer that for you momentarily. So Tanya Nami Hachi, the Gemara now cites a Brisa, an earlier Tanyetic text to support this assertion. Lo yumas al pi eid echad. One does not get put to death by one witness. Lahavi shnaim sheroim oso echad mechalon zeh v'echad mechalon zeh. Vein roin zeh zeh sheim etzdarfin. So the assumption is that they do not see each other, and that is why they do not combine. So whereas in our Mishnah, there was a little bit more flexibility. You see, only one guy from one group had to see one guy from the other group. But here, where you're really just down to one witness on one side, one on the other, they both have to see each other. Otherwise, game over. They don't combine. So if they do see each other, however, then, and assuming somebody's giving hasra as well, then they would combine to as one kat to give testimony and also potentially to become Adam Zomimin. Now that's one case. Below O, but the Brisa tells us another permutation. Right? Let's say you're not in one of these like new modern constructs where some of the new buildings in the city, it's all windows. The entire building is all windows. You know, you can like see right through to everything, or they can see through to everything. So let's say you're one of these older buildings, right? You just have like a little peephole right out of the building, a small little window. So they have to take turns viewing the murder take place. So the Brisa comes to tell me, what's this verse telling us? That if they had to take turns seeing the same deed get done, they would not combine as one count of witnesses because they did not see the entire act as one group. Mm-hmm. Now, what might you ask me? Now, the Lashon of the Gemara, the language is blow owed. It sounds like I would never have thought this on my own, but here's the thing. Amar le Rav Papa l'Abaye, hashta uma echad mechalon zeh v'echad mechalon zeh. Taika chazi kulu maisa, v'aika chazi kulu maisa, amit lo mitzdarfi. So wait, I could have made a kal v'chomer, because if you're going to tell me that if one witness from one side and one witness from the other side don't always combine, and they saw the entire deed get done. Reuven from one building saw the entire thing. Shimon from the other side saw the entire thing get done. And even they won't always combine with each other. So in this case, it's even worse. Because if Reuven only saw half of the deed get done, and Shimon only saw half of the deed get done, then that's for sure not as as compelling of a testimony as two people who saw the entire deed be performed, just albeit they didn't see each other while it was happening. So that's what the Gemara asks. I could have obviously inferred that on my own. Why? What kind of case would this even be valid testimony? You don't even see the entire deed, right? I mean, it takes 1 second to stab him, right? Somebody must have missed something during their testimony while they were viewing it. So the Gemara says, Amar lei lo nitzcha ela labol esha erva. Rather, what kind of case where witnesses could take turns viewing and they could still see enough that they could testify against the defendant? So a case of like a bol esha erva, someone is having sexual relations, illicit sexual relations. So it's possible that someone could come in one moment, see part of the act, someone come in and see another part of the act, and they both saw enough that each one can testify based on what they saw, even though they weren't viewing at exactly the same time. And it's not limited to, it just, the Gemara gives that as an example. The Tos Mishants and a few other Rishonim point out, really this applies to any violation in the Torah where it takes more than 1 second to complete. That if one witness sees one half, one sees the other, I would have thought that they would combine. Kamash Malan, the Torah comes to tell me that both witnesses need to see the same act at the same time. If they're looking at different times, they might be seeing different things, and we're not going to combine them into one kot because they have to give the same testimony. They didn't see mamish, literally, the same act in front of them. They both saw two very bad things, but they were two different acts that they were seeing. So they do not combine according to this. We'll pause here for a moment. Any questions, clarifications, any thoughts or insights on this piece of Gemara? Yes, Jeremy.
I just think that this it fits in with what we've been learning over the last several weeks, which is this is the way that the Gemara, that the Talmud, that the Torah is, that the Bet Din is getting to credible, reliable witnesses. And it's kind of a vetting process. It's very strict as to who actually can serve as a witness and how much they have to see and how much they have to be involved in the act to be credited as a witness. And it seems like a lot of potential witnesses or potential evidence could be pre-excluded. So that by the time that you get before the Beit Din, you have what should be a very compelling set of evidence from the witnesses that would enable the appropriate judgment. And that's what all of these chapters, all these verses seem to be pointing to, the different permutations of, the Adim Zomamin and how involved they need to be. And I don't think that it's necessarily the warning is like, oh, murder's bad. I think that it's talking about, a situation of passion where, you have someone who's so angry and he's ready to kill someone. Mm-hmm. And then someone says, hey, just, it's not worth it. Relax, calm down. At that moment, a decision, a conscious decision is made to ignore that warning or to go forward and kill someone. And it's the difference between right. homicide and murder. Well, and right. and so all these things are kind of playing into that.
Right. So we're going to talk actually a little later in the Gemara toward the bottom of the page. We're going to talk about what the purpose of Hasra is, why we give the warning. So we'll actually elaborate on that. But your point's well taken that the threshold and qualifications for being a valid witness in court are certainly very high. Because again, the Torah very much does not want to be putting people to death right and left. And so it sets very high standards before we impose corporal punishment and certainly capital punishment. So that's why these are in place. Okay, now Rava teaches us something very important. Amar Rava, im hayu roen es hamasre o masa roen osan mitstarpin. So here's a question I'm surprised nobody asked me yet. I'm sure some of you were thinking of it though. You'll know what I mean. Remember in our mission we said that let's say some of the witnesses see some of the witnesses, then they combine with each other to become one kat. What about the guy in the middle? What about the guy, this is in the first opinion, that you don't need the same people who are warning him to also be the ones who testify against him. So what about that guy in the middle, the masra, the guy who's, right, you have two witnesses in one building, two witnesses in another building, and there's one guy in the middle saying, hey, buddy, don't murder this guy. You're not going to want to do it. You're going to get capital punishment. I suggest you don't try that. And he does it anyway. So Rava tells us something very important, that whether it be a case of one witness in one building, one witness in the other, or two in one building and two in the other, if they could make eye contact, well, not literally eye contact, but if they see the masra, they see the guy giving the warning, and the guy giving the warning sees both pairs, he could work as a link in the chain to combine them into one group. It's almost similar. I'm not an expert in this, but there's laws of how you combine to become part of a minyan. So we always have this issue that, let's say, like someone, you know, walks out and we're in the chapel. So somebody like goes into the into that little closet in the back, or someone walks a little bit into the front. So at what point are they, you know, and we have nine, it's happened before, literally middle of minyan. Someone has to take a call and they go into like the front room area. So at what point are they no longer considered present for creating a minyan? So if they're viewing each other, if some people from the minyan can see him, he might combine with them. Yes, Toby?
He wouldn't have to combine with both sets, would he? Wouldn't it be enough if
it would be
he combined one of the sets?
That is correct. It would, well, right, but he doesn't, then it doesn't really do much for us. But the idea is that if he sees both sets, then he combines everybody into one pair.
Right. But in terms of his testimony being valid and the whole thing being executable because one of the witnesses gave a warning. It doesn't have to be both witnesses giving a warning, right? It's only one.
Oh, so then you can have because we're in the first.
So if the guy down on the street sees the guys in the window and they see him, and the guy in the street gives the warning, it should all be good enough.
Well, technically, right? According to the first opinion, they don't even need to see each other, and that's actually the next line in Rava. So I'm glad you asked that question, Toby. But Amar Rava. Masra sha'amru afilu mipi atzmo v'afilu mipi hashed. In fact, here's two uncommon cases. If the murderer gives hasra to himself, or if there's literally a demon, a shade, a voice comes out of nowhere and gives him a warning, that also is sufficient for hasra. It constitutes a legitimate hasra. And all we need is for the witnesses to see. The witnesses don't need to combine. We don't literally need a man there giving hasra. There just needs to be hasra from somewhere. So if he I don't know why he would do it, but if he warns himself out loud, or if a voice comes out of nowhere and warns him, then that is enough to constitute hasra. And then the two witnesses testify on what they saw.
Rabbi, you should just be aware in the art scroll, in the English, they have in parentheses the victim.
The victim.
That's who they mean. It says,
well, that's how they're, Rava, that's how they're
the one giving the warning of whom they spoke may even be the victim himself.
Interesting. That's how they read it. Let's see. That's I have a sift over here. I wonder if it's be funny if it's like a machlokis between them. Let's see.
And it says, our explanation follows Rashi, Rambam,
Yeah, I see.
Okay, that. I'm not going to argue with them. Fine, that's probably correct then. Misreading on my part.
But I always thought that the witnesses couldn't be witnesses unless they were the ones giving the warning.
That's the second.
Now we're
opinion.
Saying they only had to hear the warning.
Right. So, Sarah, that's the machlokis in the Mishnah. That's the argument. So what you're saying is Rav Yossi's opinion, which is the second opinion of the Mishnah. This stage of the Gemara is still analyzing the first opinion of Tanakhama, who say that the Hasra and the actual testimony, people give testimony, can be from two separate sources. So let me just check that just in case. Epi Atzmo, Shehisra, Behoreg, Kodem, Shaharku. Oh, okay, you're right. All right, I saw Horeg over there, and that's what confused me. So yes, it was the person being murdered warned the murderer prior to being killed. Yes, that is correct. Thanks for catching that. Okay, but that speaks to the point. Now, the question is also, I wonder if Arsene...
And he can't possibly... He's not a witness.
Right. He's... Exactly. You don't need to be a witness to give Hasra. That's the point being made. That's another good observation. We pointed out that last week, that he's not considered Mekayme Davar. He's one of the people who's in the deed itself. He can't be a witness. You're right. So now also, I don't know if Arsene will bring this in the footnotes, but it's interesting, if you look at Rambam, he classically omits the word shade when he codifies this. The Rambam doesn't say if a voice comes from a shade, a demon, because Rambam didn't believe in demons. Rambam was a rationalist. So Rambam, I think in Mishnah Torah, when he codifies this halacha, he just says a voice came from somebody else who was there. Or I'm not sure exactly his lashon, but he doesn't make any reference to a supernatural voice coming out from the great beyond, which is very classic Rambam as a rationalist thinker and a non-mystic thinker. So that's like an interesting tidbit to pick up on if you see that. Okay. Any other outstanding questions on this little piece? Great. Weiter, onward. Amar Rav Nachman. So now here's the thing. This disqualification of one witness not seeing the other. Oh, did it just freeze? Everyone still here? I think my computer froze. Everyone back? We're good?
I got some spotty audio here.
Yeah, it's like totally underwater.
Okay, are you able to hear me now?
Send the chat.
Can't hear you.
Not able to hear? Oh, man. Okay, let me see if I could.
I think he's off.
Maybe he was going to log back in or something.
I'm back. Is everyone here?
The best way is for him to go off and back on again.
Does everyone see me?
Yeah.
Yeah, now we got you.
Oh, okay, sorry about that. I just made sure we turned off Wi-Fi on my phone and on the TV in the house, so hopefully that gives us enough energy here. But everyone can hear me fine?
Yeah. Very great.
It's like Hollywood Squares where you changed location here.
All right. So let's go forward. Okay. So remember, we said if one witness can't see the other witness, they do not combine. Now, is that only said for capital punishment, for capital matters, or for malchus matters when you're getting corporal punishment, or this is applied to all cases? Now, what's the reason that it might only apply in cases of capital punishment, but not in cases, let's say, like dine mumnus in monetary matters? Now, the reason is
the standard is much higher in the capital cases.
Very good. So Rashi quotes the pasuk v'tzilu
right.
V'tzilu eseida, as Henry points out, that we have an imperative to try to save people's lives whenever we're able to do so. So if there's any kind of evidence, any reason to doubt that this person committed something that would incur the death penalty, we then do not give the death penalty. So Amarav Nachman. Amarav Nachman, Eidus Miyucheres Kisheir B'dinei Mumnus. When it comes to monetary matters where the stakes aren't as high, we accept two witnesses as being part of the same cot, even if they're in separate buildings and they don't see each other. Dichsiv lo yomus api eid echad. Because why? Where do we learn that Eidus Miyucheres, that one guy here, one guy there, they don't combine if they don't see each other? From the verse where it says, that someone should not be put to death by one witness here, one witness over there. So that's Bedine and the Fashas who de'ink Shera. Aludine Mamnus Kshera. When it comes to monetary matters, the bar is lower. We're not trying to save lives here. Therefore, we combine the two witnesses together when it comes to monetary matters. However, Maskivla Rav Zutra, if the whole goal is to have a higher bar when it comes to Dini Nefashas, when it comes to life and death matters, then why don't we apply the same principle in the Mishnah? There's an inconsistency here. You see, because by having a higher bar to combine one witness and one witness, on the one hand, by having a higher bar, by making it harder to combine them, it makes it harder for them to combine to then testify and put somebody to death, right? We understand that. The thing is, though, if we were to lower the bar for combining witnesses, go back to the case of our Mishnah. In the case of our Mishnah, I have two witnesses in one building and two witnesses in the other building. So if we take an approach where we do not combine the witnesses, where we make it hard to combine one pair with the other pair, what's going to happen? We get the case of our Mishnah, where the first pair can become Edom Zomimin, and the defendant will still get put to death. Whereas, if we had a lower bar, and we were able to combine both pairs of witnesses, even if they don't see each other, what happens? Then, if another pair comes in, a third pair of witnesses comes in, and they see that two of the guys become Edom Zomimin, well, you can't put anybody, you can't convict anyone of Hazama, of being Edom Zomimin, until you convict the entire cot of being Edom Zomimin. So actually, if we're trying to save lives, in our case of our Mishnah, we would want to make it easier for witnesses to combine with each other. Whereas in the case of the Gemara of Edus Miucheres, where it's one witness and one witness, we want to make it harder for them to combine so they can't testify against somebody and put them to death. Mm-hmm. So here's the issue. A leniency in one case is a stringency in the other case. So therefore, Kasha, the Gemara leaves with a question. That's a good point. And we assume Edus Miucheres is problematic. It's not accepted, whether we're talking about corporal punishment, capital punishment, monetary law, because otherwise we're left with an inconsistency here where we allow witnesses, we make it hard for them to combine, but it could lead to more deaths in the end of the day because we didn't let them combine into one big group, which becomes harder to convict the entire group of Hazama. Okay, that part may have been a little bit more complicated, and I hope I explained it clearly, but I want to pause. Can I explain that a little more clearly? Any questions? Or was that understandable? Okay. We're shaking our heads. We're processing it. It took me a moment to process it when I was first learning it. So, okay. Now, next part. So up until this, let's just make sure we understand the landscape of the Gemara. Up until this point, we were addressing and analyzing the first opinion in the Mishnah. The opinion in the Mishnah, the Tana Kama, that one guy can give the Hasra and two witnesses don't have to give the Hasra. They just need to know the Hasra was done and that they testify that they saw the murder get done. That's all that has to happen. We are now going to talk about Rav Yossi, who assumes that the same people who testify against the defendant also need to be the same people who gave Hasra, who warned the two become murderer. So Rav Yossi Omer, continuing in the Gemara, you see the two dots, Rav Yossi Omer, two dots surrounding it. Amar Lei, Rav Papa La Abaye. Rav Papa said to Abaye, Umi Islay Rav Yossi Hai Svara? Does Rav Yossi in our Mishnah really believe this? That it needs to be the same witnesses giving Hasra and testifying against him? Bahatnan, we taught in another Mishnah. Let's see, where's the other Mishnah? On Tesam and Beis. We'll get there hopefully in a few weeks, in a number of weeks. Rav Yossi Omer, Hasone Neharag, Mipnei Shukamuad Umusra. That, let's say, Reuven and Shimon, they didn't get along with each other. I don't know, you know, Reuven sat in Shimon's place in Shul one Shabbos, and then they became sworn enemies for life based on that. I don't know, you can think of some silly, it happens unfortunately, but you know, like some sort of silly story like that. So we know that Reuven despises Shimon. So usually someone requires Hasra in order to be put to death. But here, where we know that Reuven had it out for Shimon this entire time, Reuven was trying to get his seed and Shul back from Shimon. So we know that when he murdered him, he knew full well this was a premeditated act. This wasn't like, oh, maybe it was self-defense, maybe it was in the moment. Like, Reuven had it out for Shimon for many weeks now, for many years, plotting his return to take his seat back in Shul. So therefore, Reuven does not need to receive Hasra, according to Rav Yossi in the Mishnah. Now the issue is, if Rav Yossi says that Reuven does not need Hasra in order to be convicted for killing Shimon, we've got a problem here. Can anyone tell what the contradiction is? Can anyone figure out what the contradiction is between Rav Yossi here and Rabbi Yossi of our Mishnah?
There's no Hasra. Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah says you have to, the witness also has to be the person giving the warning.
Right. And so let's sharpen Henry's point. According to Tanakhama, Hasra is not an integral part of the testimony. Hasra is just an additional prerequisite. It's not a component of the testimony itself. Whereas according to Yossi, the Hasra is part of the Maisa Edus. It's a part of the test of becoming a witness. If you're missing Hasra, you're not a witness. So for Yossi, who Hasra is an integral part of the definition of witnessing and then testifying on a murder, how could he be the one who says, by the way, in a case where Reuven had it out for Shimon, Reuven doesn't need Hasra. There's no edus according to him then. Where's the testimony?
No, it's an exception. Why can't it just be an exception to needing Hasra?
Because the issue is, I mean, we could say it's an exception, but you have to explain why. You see, I can understand according to the Tanakhama why there'd be an exception. Because according to Tanakhama, the idea, what's the definition of witnessing and testimony? Seeing something happen. Hasra is a prerequisite for unclear cases. But according to Yossi, it's there as an integral part of the testimony itself, it sounds like. So
I got a question. We have the murder and he has it out for his victim for the last 6 months. But how's the court going to learn that? You need testimony.
How's the court going to... Sorry, Zadie.
To have the state of mind that's requisite to constitute murder as opposed to negligent homicide.
Right. So that's a good point that I didn't think of when I was reading the Gemara. My grandfather asked, which is, well, how do we establish that Reuven hated Shimon? So I think, right, is it that we need two witnesses to then testify that Reuven hates Shimon? Or is it possible, you know, that this is just something that was known to everyone? We see that sometimes there is an idea of public knowledge. Sometimes there's like a Gemara, I forgot where it is, but it talks about if someone has rumors that he's committing illicit activities. And even though there's no clear testimony against him, if it's known that he's doing it, it's enough for us to act on it. In our Monday night class, when we're going through a Moshe Sternbach, and he was talking about a child molester, he said there was no clear testimony against him, but it was corroborated by many sources that they saw that something was happening, and so it was enough to act upon. So we do see that sometimes, and that's really left up to the discretion of Beis Din.
I would assume that every trial is not just two sets of witnesses. I saw him kill him, and that's it. I mean, there could be a need for a lot of, right? I mean, all kinds of issues or questions or possible defenses. So you could be having a lot of witnesses. And in this kind of a case, this would be something that people would come in and testify about. And you wouldn't need to have two sets of witnesses necessarily, because it's just an element. It's not the commission of the crime itself.
Ah, okay. Right. That's a good point. So Toby's saying is that finding out whether someone's a Sony or not might not require actual aidus, because that's not really what's convicting him. I hear that.
Okay. There's also a whole backstory here, Rabbi. I mean, this has been going on for months and months and months and months. We're only hearing the very last moment where he actually commits the crime. Right. I mean, who knows? You know, Reuven, this is a bad idea. Reuven, forgive him. Reuven, this is not such a big deal. Reuven, why are you so upset? Right? We don't know the whole backstory behind all the discussion that's been had ahead of time.
Right. So that's a good point. So you know what? You'll remind me. This is on, I think, Tess Amid Bays. So we'll get there in about 5 weeks. So when we're there, God willing, I'll look more into the Mefarshim, the commentaries on there, because that's actually where the Sugya proper exists. And I'm sure the commentaries on the passage on Tess Amid Bays will address this question in more depth. So these are good questions. I don't have the answers yet, but God willing, at which point that we actually learn this mission inside, we'll hopefully see some approaches to this. But back to our question. How could Rav Yossi, who championed the need for Hasra, Hasra is an integral part, and it needs to be the same guys who do Hasra that testify, how could he all of a sudden deny the importance of Hasra so willy-nilly just because the guy was a Sone, because we know he hated the other guy? So the answer is, here's an easy answer. You need to get yourself out of something. Amar Lei, Ahu Rav Yossi Bar Yehuda, he. It's a different Rabbi Yossi. The Tanya, Rav Yossi Bar Yehuda Omer, Chover ain't Sarach Hasra, just, it's a different Rabbi Yossi. As we record in a Brisa, in our Mishnah, it's plain Rabbi Yossi. Over here, this statement that we found that's contradictory is Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda, a different person. Rabbi Yossi, the son of Yehuda. It's a different Rabbi Yossi. And that Rabbi Yossi is the one who has a very elastic definition of when Hasra is needed and when it's not. And he says also, someone who is learned, who understands the ramifications for committing murder and what Beis Din will do to him, he doesn't need Hasra. So that's a different Rab Yossi. That's the answer over here, right? So you ever need that? That's always a pretty easy answer, right? It's almost like changing the girsa. You change the text. Now there's no contradiction. No lumdisha answer. It's just a very simple, these are two different guys who share the same first name. They didn't say the same thing. That's it. That's an easy answer right there. Get us out of this. Okay, one last thing I want to share. Let's get to the Mishnah on the next page. The last part of the Mishnah said that you cannot use a translator to translate the testimony of the witnesses to the dayanim, to the judges. Now, in addition to it being derived from the verse, it said, apishnayim edim, by the mouths of these witnesses, it's also logical because last thing you need is that the witnesses are going to give their testimony, and then the guy translating just botches it up. So we want to make sure that there's no broken telephone. So even just from a svara standpoint, from a logical standpoint, it resonates. So here's the thing, though. Hahanu luaze da'os lekame derava. We're on the third to last line at the two dots. There were these two people who spoke a foreign language that came before Rava's court. Uki Rava Turgum Beinayim, and Rava placed a translator between the both of them, between the witnesses and himself. Where asks, Behechi Ovid Haki, how is he allowed to do this? That's not Shalotesan Hedges Shemasi Rava Turgumon. Doesn't Rava's practice contradict what our Mishnah told us? You're not allowed to use a translator. So what was Rava thinking? Did he miss a Mishnah in class that day? So Rava made the Hava Yoda Mada Havu Amri. Vadurehu Delo Hava Yoda. So Rava actually knew what they were saying. You know, I have this many times. We have some Israelis in the community. So I met someone the other day. I don't remember her name per se. She lives off taught at the bicultural for a while. On Boxwood area. Anyone know who I'm talking about? Okay. There's like an Israeli couple over there who taught at bicultural for a while. So
the Seifers?
Yeah, the Seifers.
Oh, they taught there for a long while.
yes.
So well, I ran anyway, not her.
Okay, so yeah, Marissa and I went on a walk the other day. We walked to Beldadi's. That way I could check Beldadi's and we could get a walk in also at the same time. So we ran into them. So she started speaking to me in Hebrew. I knew enough to understand what she was saying, but I didn't feel like putting in the effort to actually talk back in Hebrew, so I just respond in English.
Believe me, she understood every word you said.
Yeah. Yeah,
she, not an issue.
Right, so exactly. So Rava was like that. Also, Rava knew enough to understand what they were saying, but it was either he didn't know enough or it was too laborious for him to start constructing articulate responses in the same language. So he didn't use a translator to translate the testimony, but rather he used his Meturgam, his translator, to respond to the witnesses. So that's okay, because then you don't have as big of an issue of the broken telephone. Okay, that sits well. Let's see, we got a question from Howard Weiss in the chat. Does it make a difference if one of the members of the Beit Din did the translating? That is a great question, Howard. Saying, let's say one of the Beit Din members, I would think not. I'm just saying intuitively, because then there could be broken telephone from that one judge who might have his biases and his preconceived notions, and he might bring that in his translation to the other Dayanim, the other judges. But possible. I didn't think of that question. It's a great question, Howard. I did not look into that, but that's my intuition.
Any translator can have his biases.
Well, that's right. Right, exactly. And that's why, just because using one of the using a judge as a translator might even be worse. Because, again, you know, the judge has to make a decision. He might translate it in a way toward his colleagues. He might translate it to them in a way that will help them reach the same conclusion as he already has.
But he's translating to the witness from what the other judge says.
That's okay. Oh, that's definitely okay. You're allowed to have a translator to translate from the judges to the witnesses, but not from the witnesses to the judges. Okay. Now, let's go on to the next section of the Gemara. This next part, the Mefarshim have no idea what it's doing over here, what the connection is. I'm not sure either, but it's a good section of Gemara. Torah's Torah. So don't ask me how this connects. The Mefarshim, the commentaries, struggle to figure it out as well. But, yeah, it's good stuff. You'll see. Ila v'tuvya kirive da'arava havu. So, I don't think we've talked about this yet, but we know the statement "Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh," that all Jewish people are Arevim for each other. I brought this up in other classes. So what does it mean we're Arevim? It means we're guarantors for each other. So what does it mean to be a guarantor? Well, our lawyers could tell us that what it means to be a guarantor is like when I got my first apartment. Marissa and I got our first apartment in Queens. So apparently my credit score wasn't as good as it is today. So what we had to do was we had to have my parents co-sign onto the lease. That way, should I fail to pay a month's rent, they would be the guarantors. They were co-signing as guarantors that they would then be paying in my stead. So here's the question. We know that witnesses cannot be valid witnesses if they are relatives to the people involved in the litigation. But let's say they are related not to the lender and not to the borrower, but they are related rather to the guarantor. Is that considered a disqualification if they are related to the guarantor who's not directly involved in this litigation here? So Ila v'Tuvya kirive da'arava havu, these two people, Ila and Tuvya, were related to the guarantor. So two opinions. Savara pabla meimar, gavi lova ma'ava rechike ninhu. Since they're not related to the borrower and the lender who are in the dispute, therefore they are valid witnesses in this case. Amalei Rav Huna, Barei de Rav Yeshua. Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua, responds to Rav Papa. Eleis lelelova, la basar arava asal malva. What do you mean? Obviously, they're not impartial, because if the malva, if the lender, can't collect money from the borrower, who are they going to come after? The Arev. They're going to come after the guarantor. So if you're related to the guarantor, then that also seems, according to at least the second opinion, would disqualify you from being a witness, a valid witness in that court case in the Beis Din. And that brings us to the next Mishnah. So let me just pause for any remaining questions. And then I want to share just a short piece that connects some of what we're talking about to Vayechulu and to Davening and to Midian a little bit. So any questions before we go to Chashukei Chemed for just a little interesting tidbit? Okay, great. Straight to Chashukei Chemed. We'll take a breath now. So remember how we were talking about do witnesses combine with one another and what circumstances so they have to see each other? So this happens to me basically every Friday night. Apparently, Rabbi Cohen's future son-in-law, Yishai Zeroin, so he davens with a lot of kavana. So what happens is on Friday night, he misses Vayechulu because he's still davening Shmona Esrei with lots of kavana. And a guy like me who has less kavana, I'm done with Shmona Esrei already. So I say Vayechulu with the entire congregation. Now, what is the statement of Vayechulu? Vayechulu is we're declaring that God. What was that, Henry? Oh, you're muted.
You're giving a dut on my separation, basically.
Ah, very good. So we're giving testimony on Maisa Bereishis. We're giving testimony that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So that's why many people, what they'll do is, if they miss saying Vayechulu with the congregation, they'll drag you over afterwards and ask you to say it with them. Because why? Because testimony requires two witnesses. So here's the question. Let's say I'm standing... we need to know a little Hilchos Shabbos, so you'll forgive me in 8 minutes we have. I don't have enough time to give a full background, so bear with me. If I'm on one side of a public domain of Rosh Hashanah, a big open area without that can't use an air for, and Shimo, my friend, is on the other side. So let's say Yishai asks me, can you say Vayechulu with me? And I'm on the other side of a public domain. So then it seems, I think it's quoted in the Beis Yosef in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah, so we know that, let's say I want to do a zimun, we're going to bench after a meal. If I'm on one side of a public domain and you're on the other side of a public domain, we do not combine for zimun, even though we see each other. So the question is, why is it that we don't combine for zimun if we see each other, but if we want to testify against somebody for committing murder, you know what? We don't care that there's a big public domain separating us. If we saw each other, we combine.
Because you're together when you're giving the testimony in court.
Okay. So that might be one answer, which is that what's the primary thing that you do as witnesses is the testimony in the court. Okay, that's an approach.
But by Zimun, it says explicitly the mission is Shlosha Shachu Ke'achad.
Very good.
How could you? I mean, you're yes, not
literally that. Very good, Henry. So Henry quotes on Brachos Daf Nun Amud Aleph, literally the words that you quoted. Shlosha Shachu Ke'achad. So he writes, when it comes to Eidos, you need one pair of witnesses that saw the same deed get committed. What's saying the mission of Brachos? What constitutes a Zimon? Three men, or three women actually, that eat together in the same place. So there's actually an important detail when it comes to Zimon. They need to be eating in the same place. If you have a Rosh Hashanah, you have a public domain separating between the two of you, you can't be said to be having a meal in the same location. Whereas when it comes to testimony, there's no obligation, requirement, no requisite for both witnesses to be in the same place. They just need to be able to see the same deed get committed. Now, so what about when it comes to Vayechulu? So here's the thing. Since Vayechulu, as Henry pointed out before, is testimony, we are testifying that God created the world, perhaps you don't need to be in the same place, right? If I'm already, I already crossed the street to get back to the manor to where I live, and Yishai is still in the Good Hashem parking lot, and we're on opposite sides of Strawberry Hill, and, well, not that Strawberry Hill is where Shisha Rabin, but let's say it was that. So then we would still be able to say Vayechulu together over the cars whizzing by, because we don't need to be in the same place to say it. It's a testimony. Testimony and witnessing and testimony doesn't need to be literally in the same place. We just need to be able to hear each other and see each other. That's what makes us into one cot of witnesses. So here's the thing, though. I may have misrepresented where Henry gave one approach to what Vayechulu is. But is Vayechulu really testimony? Are you really testifying? I'll give you one example. Like, number one, you're not saying in front of a Beis Din. So that should be one giveaway that this isn't real testimony. Number two, even if you were, you want to say that the congregation listening forms a basin also somehow. I don't know how you'd say that. But, you know, basin isn't open at night. Basin can only judge during the day. That's a rule. So vayichulu, though, we always say at nighttime. So it's very clear that this isn't a serious bona fide form of testimony. Otherwise, you know, at very least, you would maybe get three men in the front of the room like we do in Rosh Hashanah, where before Rosh Hashanah when we do Hataras Nedarim, but you don't even do that for vayichulu. So is this really testimony? No. So therefore, the Chazon Ish says that when we say vayichulu, it's not testimony, but rather, what's the importance of saying vayichulu together if it's not testimony? Let each everyone say it at their own pace. Why do we need to say, why do we need to do that together? Because
right.
Because it's a way of almost like presume nisa we talk about. We are being mefarsim. We are publicizing the glory of God. And the more people join together in unison to glorify God, we say Rav Mahadras Melech. The more people glorifying God, the more glory to God if we do it together. Ah, so then here's the thing. If it's not about testimony, it's about glorifying God. Maybe if I'm in one location, Yishai's in the other location, maybe we don't combine for the purpose of joining together to praise God, because it's not clear to a passerby that Yishai and I are celebrating and praising God together if we're in two different locations. But on the other hand, you could say that since maybe this isn't a real testimony, and maybe even from this perspective, we could combine. So basically, if you walk away with something, I don't know if you're the type of person who's very makbid, say vayichulu with somebody if you missed it with the congregation, but you should just know it's not real testimony. Because if there's one thing we're walking away from all these classes learning, as Jeremy is always happy to remind us, is that there's a very high bar for being a witness. And there's a lot of qualifications for being legitimate witnesses in Beis Din. So if you think, after all what we're learning in Makos, that what's going on when we say Vayichulu on Friday night, that that's a form of testimony, you got a really hard argument to make based on everything that we're learning. It's a great thing to say. Try to say it with the congregation. It doesn't hurt to say it with somebody if you missed it afterwards. But it's certainly not a bona fide form.
I always interpreted that as symbolic. It wasn't. Yeah. It was never meant to be real test. It was more like a symbolism than actual legal testimony.
Of course. So, but then the question is, Henry, so if that's true, do I really need to be so machmid that if I miss it with the tzibor, I now need to like hold one guy up from going back to eat supper with it? I'm not blaming Yishai. It's okay. I'm hanging back a few minutes anyway. But do I need to like hold up another guy to say vayichulu with him because I missed it? So if you're like, you know, you really think it's a form of testimony, then great. And this is relevant also to Kiddush Friday night. Those who were with us in the early Pinini Halacha days, we did Hilchos Kiddush. So why do some people stand for Kiddush? Because Kiddush also, you say Vayichulu again, right? You say Vayichulu. It's a form of testimony. And that's why you stand, because you stand when you give testimony in the witness stand. So there is that element there. But Henry, I believe you're correct. It's certainly not bona fide Eidus, but it's a symbolic form of Eidus and a very important one at that. Okay. Any questions on that piece?
Couldn't we say that we are affirming to our Hashem, our belief in Him, and when more than one Jew does it at the same time, we join together, it has a greater effect?
Absolutely. And that's the approach of the Chazon Ish, Zadie. And so that's the argument, that there's no need to be perhaps so strict on the parameters, because it's not testimony. It's just the more people glorifying God, the better it is. Rav Mahadras Melech. So that's perhaps the idea. Okay, Yasher Koach, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And God willing, stay tuned for next week, where we plan, Be'ez Hashem, to finish the first chapter, the first parak of Maseches Makos. So get the scotch ready. Open up Irwin's liquor closet. We're going to, you know, if you have a whole kiddush for it, a whole siyum. There is one, actually, will be a siyum. March 25th, But I'll be a CM for the Bechorim, for the firstborn. So maybe we'll slip ours in there also. Who knows?
Scott.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Okay. Have a good night, everyone. Good job. Good night.